You're listening to A Horse Walks Into a Bar Masterclass.
Hello and welcome. It's sales season, or more accurately, in the 2020s, it's rarely not sales season. And the Bible for anybody shopping, selling, or just following along is a meticulously compiled tome of distilled history known as a catalogue. Whether it's physical or digital, this often weighty piece of work is part guide, part run sheet, and part, well, sales catalogue. Each page focuses on a single lot, and for those that have been around the bloodstock industry, it's a useful, sometimes fascinating touchstone when assessing a horse's potential worth and appeal. But to everyone else, it can be mystifying. Even to racing fans who may be familiar with some of the names contained in pedigree pages and who are used to working their way through the equally dark art of deciphering form, a pedigree page can be TMI. So that's where my fellow enthusiast Fionnuala Timoney comes in. Not only has Fionnuala enjoyed success sourcing animals at auction, but she does a lot of pedigree work for her employers, Coolmore Stud. And most importantly, she loves pedigrees. Fionnuala, welcome back. Let's start with your pedigree, as it were. How did you come to love the art of deciphering these wonderful snapshots in time?
I started with a project in secondary school, actually. I think a history project where I researched my Irish sport horse's pedigree at the time for a history project. And he was by an Irish draft, but out of he's by a thoroughbred out of an Irish draft mare. So I researched the thoroughbred side of his lineage, and that just from there it got me hooked in the whole bloodlines thing, and I suppose the art of reading a pedigree and devising mating plans, and it all sort of grew from there.
How long do you think it was before you started to get a handle on pedigrees after that interest was sparked?
Oh, I think, remember at the time, you know, at the Racing Post, the paper that you'd get, I think it was every Tuesday or Wednesday, Tony Morris would always do a piece on a sort of dissecting a pedigree, and he had a wonderful way with words on how to even describe a pedigree and the terminology in that. And I found myself, you know, saving these articles and pulling them out of the paper each week. And I guess it was just something that sort of, yeah, you gradually start learning more and more. And then when I started in working in the thoroughbred industry, and you get talking to people, and, you know, when you're doing yearling preps and you start taking a look at the pedigrees and trying to understand, you know, what it is people are looking for at the sales, and kind of stemmed from that, really.
I'm glad you brought up Tony Morris, because people like Tony are really invaluable in bringing pedigrees to life in a way, and putting them in a context that can be addressed by the every person, because they are so articulate and they have such a wonderful way with words. And I'd encourage any young people listening, you can dig up a lot of Tony's work online. The Racing Post archives have a lot of his work, and obviously he's written a few books as well, so check him out. And there are many other pedigree legends out there that make that sort of stuff accessible. Let's get into this, because you're a pedigree legend. We're going to give people a few pointers in a way to attack a catalogue. As always with these specials, this advice is general in nature. No two people agree 100% of the time on things in a pedigree. Let's start broadly. What's your process once a catalogue is released? What is the first thing you'll do, and where do you go from there?
I think with any, I like to go through a catalogue chronologically always, because I just think it's a more balanced, unbiased way to look at it, because I think if you try and zone in on particular stallions and things from the very beginning, you know, you're making a shortlist really before you've even gone through the catalogue. The one exception, all right, is from a work point of view, if I'm going through a yearling catalogue, I'd always just do our own draft first, you know, and annotate those pedigrees, purely for the fact that, you know, when you have on-farm yearling parades, if you have the research and the notes done, you know, for the team on those ones, you know, they have everything at their hand when clients and that come to the farm to inspect those horses. But once that's out of the way, I will literally go back to lot one and just page by page go through it. You know, and sometimes you're working off, you know, you might have a few different lists that you, you know, you need to make shortlists for, or, you know, let's say different criteria. So you might be jotting down and making, you know, several different lists depending for what you're particularly looking for in a particular sale. I'll generally basically make a note of what ones I want to annotate. And, you know, by that I mean do further research into and actually, you know, start making notes on what you can't see on the page, let's say, you know, what's coming through on the pedigree itself. What other progeny are there in the background that you can't see on the actual sales catalogue page. And yeah, that's for the, you know, traditional, let's say, live sale catalogues. For the online sale catalogues, like from my point of view, I'm nearly always just, you know, looking for the race filly section or the mare section. But so I'll go through those one by one. But having said that, I'll always make a point with online sales of just going through the entire index, you know, like where you can see the sire and dam of each lot, because I often find, you know, particularly you'll get to recognize a lot of dams' names, you know, and you don't need a photographic memory, but the more you actually make an effort to just read them, you know, you'll, even when you're looking at race results and things, and something will click with you. But from my point of view, I like going through those indexes because you might spot something that's out of a mare you own, or you know it's related to them. You know, and it could be a gelding in the racehorse section, you know, for example, and you know, it could be a 2 or 3 year old out of one of your horses, and you might have been, you know, expecting a pedigree update from that horse, for example. So, you know, take a closer look then, see why they're so old. Is it that, you know, they might have been up to a certain level of racing, or they might have had a setback. You know, you might find them in an after track section of a sale, and you know, they're not going to bring an update. So from that point of view, I think it is a good habit to get into trying to go through the whole index of those online sales.
It sounds like it's just work. Keep working at it, look at everything, and work your way through from go to woe, at least on a very surface level. When you address an individual pedigree, where does your eye go first on the page? What's the first thing you habitually look at when you're looking at an individual pedigree?
Always the very top. So like that, basically the pedigree grid itself, what the actual bloodlines are, the sire and dam, you know, are they, you know, straight away, is it, you know, the dam, you know if she was a good racehorse or not, but more so like that female family. Is it one you're familiar with? You know, is this horse bred on a, you know, a cross or a good nick that you're already familiar with? You know, at a glance from looking at that pedigree grid, if there's close, you know, inbreeding or line breeding, you see that it might attract you, it might put you off. But I always like to try and look at the bloodlines themselves before glancing down the page, because often you know, if you see, you know, 4 or 5 dams on the page, or and you know, page is looking rather white and lacking a lot of black type, you know, it's very easy to flip past that pedigree quickly. So I think it's a good habit to try and look at the bloodlines before anything else.
Is there anything when you look at that 3-generation pedigree that is an instant disqualifier for you personally, or generally is that your sort of grounding, your foundation before you get into the rest of the page?
No, I think you know, if it's, again, it depends, you know, what you're looking for. You know, if I'm looking at a mare's, you know, filly or mare, let's say for Coolmore, you know, you can garner a lot from those, you know, the first three dams, and it would want to be generally, you know, a very strong pedigree up top from a commercial point of view and for what their particular criteria is. But then, you know, if you're shopping at a level, more entry level, and, you know, you're not going to, let's say me personally, I know I mightn't be able to afford a stakes winner or even a city winner. So you start looking down a bit more to what's on the page. I know some people would rule out certain things. You know, I know some agents, I've heard them often say they'd never, whether it's a yearling's page or a mare's page, they don't like to buy something if they can't see that there's already at least one group one winner on the page. Me personally, I don't have rules like that. I'd like to see how the family has done with the particular, I suppose, level of stallions they've been bred to. Like, Are they, you know, upgrading the stallions, let's say, or is it, you know, a very well-related mare that, you know, has been given her chance with, let's say, you know, the top-tier stallions, and has she, what has she produced going to those? Or is it a, you know, might be a lower-tier family that has maybe exceeded expectations, and, you know, they might have had a good runner or two that are by, let's say, mediocre sires, so you can garner a lot from the actual results of when you bear in mind the level of stallions used. I think it's important to remember.
Yeah, there's a lot of context you sort of have to add in, isn't there? I have one question that might be a little bit controversial. It may not be. There has always been, traditionally, in a catalogue pedigree, between the three-generation page and the listing of the dam's produce, a quick summary of what the stallion's done.
Yeah.
In 2023, is that relevant? Or if you're fair dinkum, should you have a good idea of whether the stallion's good or bad?
Yeah, look, it's probably... I mean, it's relevant in that it's very important information, but does it need to be on the page itself? I mean, probably not, because, you know, you're doing your own research, really, and, you know, the very most basic start is really to look into the stallion and the dam. So whether it's already on the page or not, for me, it doesn't make a huge difference, because particularly I find, like, if it's an international sire, I mightn't be too familiar with, you know, even listing out those progeny. You know, the way it's listed, I think it just goes by, you say stakes winners, stakes placed, you know, so you still have to, you know, look up more in-depthly to see actually the level, what level of races they won, and, you know, what percentage, let's say, of stakes winners to runners, etc. they might have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing I would say is you could probably use a little bit more of that data in that section. It's maybe that the section's not necessarily irrelevant, but the way the data is presented is a little bit old-fashioned now that we rely on so much statistical information rather than just a listing of their good runners and that sort of stuff.
And I think also, you know, they're automatically feeding in the, you know, the stakes wins. But, you know, in this day and age, particularly in Australian racing, I'm not sure if they'd feed in the likes of an Everest win, let's say, or the Gong or that, if they're not black type races. So it's probably not giving an accurate as portrayal as it could give.
Okay. So aside from the pedigree supplied by the sales company, what other tools might you use apart from, and you've already hinted at some of this, it's doing the legwork day in, day out, and keeping track of what's happening in the industry, essentially, and the trends that are happening. But are there actual other tools that you employ in your analysis of a catalogue page?
Yeah, like the first step for me is always doing a research document with Arian, or, you know, Bloodhound would have a similar document, and, you know, from that you'll be able to see the actual progeny sales history. You'll see the progeny that aren't on the page in the sales catalogue. So if you're just trying to garner what, you know, potential for pedigree updates, you'll also see, you know, what's not there. You know, if there might be a few horses, you know, close relations that are actually deceased, for example, and that's not always not visible even on the research document. Like, I find it's understandable a two-year-old, let's say, wouldn't be named particularly this time of year, but if I was looking at a page this time of year and there's a three-year-old or over not named, I'd probably look up the that horse in the stud book, and you might find that it's been, you know, returned as deceased, so which isn't a reason to strike a mare off your page, but at least you know what you're dealing with, and you know that, you know, what might have been, let's say, an I Am Invincible three-year-old that sold for $500,000 to Gay Waterhouse, and that could have, you know, been an exciting one for an update, you know, if you realize it's no longer with us. That's important information.
It's sort of filling in the grey area, isn't it? I suppose when you're shopping for mares and that sort of thing, if the mare has a few convictions in terms of the, you know, she slipped or or, you know, she hasn't had any runners, you know, what is there context to be added there? As you said, have they died in a freak accident rather than it being a trend or something like that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, aside from, so that's sort of your basic, like, let's say annotations, we'll call them, the basic notes you'd be writing up. But like, then to go a bit extra, like I'd always, again, if, you know, if you might, from your research, you'll see what unraced progeny a mare might have coming through. It's not going to tell you there on the page who the trainer is if they haven't had a start yet. So I always like to look up Riza or the equivalent website, see what stable that horse is in. You know, you'll see from the stable's return if it's currently in training or spelling or might be transferred, which, you know, hints that it's been sold or maybe about to be retired. From a online sales perspective, you generally can often have to think a bit outside the box with your research, particularly if a listing mightn't have the best, let's say, photos and videos going with it. So I like to dig a bit deeper, because often, like, that's where you can get value, is, you know, people don't often present their horse for sale online in as good a light as they could. So rather than being put off by, you know, one photo that they've put up that you can't really see the horse's confirmation, it's worth trying to find, can you find other places online with it? And if, for example, you know, there's a four-year-old maiden mare for sale, you know, go and see if she went through a yearling sale. And, you know, they often have. And, you know, those more recent horses will have nearly always have the yearling photos. They'll be parade footage on their on the Inglis or Magic Millions websites if you look up the past auctions. And, you know, at least then you can actually see a video of them. You can see their action. You can assess their confirmation. Another one I occasionally use if I, you know, if something hasn't gone through a sale and I'm trying to find some photographs of it, is literally look up photographers' websites. You know, if a horse is won or placed, you know, look up Bradley Photographers or the equivalent, and you'll often find photos of them in a pre-parade ring or, you know, in the saddling area after a win. And again, there might actually be better photos on there from a point of view of, you know, even a front-on photo if you're worried that, you know, maybe the horse has bad knees or something and the seller online has only put on a side-on photo. You can often find a bit more if you do a bit of digging. Twitter is another one, you know, literally search the horse's name. If they've, you know, raced in the last few years, you know, put in the horse's name, maybe along with the race name. Like, it's a quick way to find the race replay itself, but you'll also even, it can be interesting, the commentary that might have surrounded that race at the time can often hint to the horse's ability or their future ability. And, you know, that might, the same goes for if, you know, a sibling to a horse you're interested in has even, you know, recently trialed or something, you know, stick it into Twitter and you'll find the replay often, and maybe some commentary on interviews from the trainers themselves on the ability they think the horse might have or otherwise.
Those are all very, very good tips. And we're talking now too, you've made your long list. You've sort of turning it into a short list. At what point do you really start to settle on the horses you very much like? Because there's a risk of you could keep going into more and more detail forever, right?
Yeah, like I normally, to be honest, for a sale, like once I've made a long list, I try and leave it at that list until the horses are actually inspected. You know, I'd rather take something off my list once you actually see the horse, as opposed to trying to pick apart its pedigree in too much detail before you've actually inspected the animal. Because, you know yourself, I think if you've put it on the list to begin with, I think there's enough there on the page, and, you know, trust your gut and just leave it on your list until you've, you know, proven otherwise when you go and inspect the horse.
And that's actually a good opportunity to make the point that this, what we're discussing, is one part of the animal selection process. The pedigree is an amazing tool.
Yeah.
That we've been given, but there are so many other factors outside of what's on the page that need to be taken into consideration when selecting a horse.
Yeah, and I think particularly, like, if you're just looking, you know, for an A-grade mare or something, you know, it's a lot easier to pick it, like, you know, the And it's quite, I wouldn't say easy, but it's not hard to pick out the very good mares in that. And, you know, going through a catalogue, you won't end up with a huge list. And, you know, likewise, even with the yearling sales, if you're picking out the colts with the best pedigrees by the best sires, you know, that's pretty much an easy shortlist to make. But if you're on a lower budget, you'll probably find that you end up with quite a long list to begin with. And that's fine, because you have to be a bit more forgiving with things. And then, you know, as I say, just create your list and then go and then start shortening it once you start inspecting them.
Well, let's talk forgives. I think that's you're giving me all the segues at this point. What is your number one forgive when you're shopping personally that other people have a real hang up about?
I often kind of see in a negative what could be a positive, because I nearly like to see, you know, if there's too many positives on the page, I'm not going to be able to afford the horse often. So I'd rather see, like, you know, I'm not going to dismiss a horse, let's say, if she's placed, as opposed to being, you know, a winner or, you know, anything above that. But like, what I will do is I'll actually look at the race record in more depth, you know. I mean, was she placed once from 40 starts and just manage a placing at the picnic races, you know, by which you can, you know, easily presume that she's just no good? Or, you know, did she have maybe 5 or 6 starts and, you know, was unlucky and had to place second, let's say, in 4 of them or something? So I'd forgive things like that if I'm going to be, you know, whether it be, you know, a yearling out of such a mare, because, you know, or whether you want to breed from such a mare, because, you know, I'll come to the conclusion that they still had good ability and, you know, if with a bit of luck, you know, the race record might have read differently. Again, if they, you know, if it's a mare you're buying and you can, you know, if she's missed, let's say, a couple of times, you know, I won't straight away dismiss that. You know, again, I'd look a bit closer and be like, look at the stud book, you know, on the given year she's missed, you know, had she foaled late and she might have, you know, only been covered once and missed. What stallion was she covered by that she missed to, you know, how's his fertility? You know, it's different if you can see that, you know, it was a barren mare to begin with and she, you know, might have been covered 4 times during the season and still missed. Well, you know, then there's warning flags. But I like to, yeah, look a bit closer into what might look like a negative on paper and actually evaluate it, and you know, you might just determine that it's not actually such a bad negative as it might look at a glance.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about mum and dad. First stallions, first season, second season, proven stallions. Do they impact your thinking at all? Are there any that you tend to stay away from, or any that you're particularly enamored with? I know from our previous chats that you love a proven stallion.
Yeah, I do. And particularly, like, if you're shopping for a mare, you know, in an ideal world, you'd like them to be by a proven stallion, you know, and that's proven as a broodmare sire. But, I mean, at the same time, too, you know, again, value can be found in maybe supporting or, you know, buying a mare by a younger stallion that hasn't, you know, had, his daughters mightn't have had runners yet, but, you know, in that case, you'd at least like them to be by a sire who he himself is a good broodmare sire. You know, he's going to have a better chance of doing the same. With regards, you know, I don't personally buy yearlings, but like if I was going to the classic sale and looking to buy a yearling, you know, I certainly wouldn't be dismissing the ones by the first and second season sires. You know, you might even pay more attention to the second or third season sires. There'd be a bit more value, you know, there'd be a little less hype over them. And it's just a case of, you know, in those instances, you know, remembering the race record of those stallions themselves. You know, they might be bred on, but they might be by the same sire that, you know, the mare herself might have already had a good horse by, etc. So you might be looking for something bred on a similar cross if they are unproven.
Do you subscribe to the old chestnut, returning to your buying broodmares by young sires, that if a stallion has shown a propensity to sire a high proportion of high-class fillies, that he is a good chance to be a good broodmare sire, or do you think that's in the old wives' tale category?
I probably don't put too much weight on it. I mean, yeah, you hear people talking about it. You know, you can, a horse like Sepoy's name comes up a bit lately when people are on about it. Like for me personally, I'd rather, you know, like generally stallions that have gone to stud at a high fee, you know, there's daughters from their early crops will end up producing good horses because, you know, they were well.
But that's because they're from good families, right?
Yeah, they're good. They're from good families, and you know, they're from a good family. And you know, someone has gone to a stallion and paid, you know, 40 or 50 grand in their first year at stud. So even if that horse, you know, pretty much failed or wasn't too successful as a sire, you know, it's the law of averages. You know, they're going to throw up a few good ones as a broodmare sire. But would I go out of my way shopping for a daughter out of one or by one of those stallions? Probably not. You know, I'd rather, if I can't afford or can't find a broodmare that's by a proven broodmare sire, I'd rather, you know, one that's by a good young stallion that, you know, has the profile that you might expect him down the track to be a good broodmare sire. And, you know, you're trying to find, you know, everyone knows now that, you know, Fastnet Rock fillies will be like Hensteet and people will be falling over trying to buy them. But, you know, there was plenty of savvy people, you know, that were seeking out his daughters, you know, 5-10 years ago. So you just have to try and find the next, let's say, Fastnet Rock that's going to be, you know, a really good broodmare sire.
Black type. For those that aren't aware, this is the bold print in a catalogue. Capitalised means a stakes winner, non-capitalised means stakes placed. Not bold means the horse hasn't finished top three in a stakes race. For Nuala, how important is black type to you, and is all black type created equal? Is that a trap for young players?
Yeah, it can be a trap. There's certainly, you know, it's like I'd often use the term weak black type or strong black type.
Yeah.
Black type is very helpful in evaluating a pedigree, but for me, I'll always, if I'm, you know, annotating a horse's pedigree, whether if the mare herself is black type or if there's any black type horses under her first dam or her first dam themselves, I'll always actually look up the time form rating. And actually, I put more of a weight then on what their time form rating is than the black type itself. Particularly, you know, if you're dealing with, like even in Australia, you know, the different racing jurisdictions, you know, what it takes to, you know, get black type in a listed race, you know, in Tasmania or New Zealand can be different from Victoria or Sydney or that. So I think actually writing the time form rating down gives you a better understanding of the actual ability of the horse. Similarly, you know, if it's a, you know, an American mare or something, you know, I wouldn't be all that familiar with, you know, the different tracks they have out there. So when you see black type, for me, an American pedigree, I'd rather find out what its time form rating is then to give me a better understanding of the quality of the race that, you know, that black type was earned in.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Inglis, Magic Millions, throw some time form ratings in these catalogues. Get rid of all that showy stuff of the sire's list of runners and give us some time form ratings. I think that's a really, really good point. All right, well, let's put some of this into practice. We've got a bit of an activity. The rise of digital sales has been huge, and you've enjoyed success in that sphere. You've picked out a pedigree for us, which people can find on our social accounts, at A Horse Walks Pod on Twitter and Insta, from a digital sale past. And we're going to go through it together. So if you're listening along and want to get involved, hit pause here and go and fetch that from our socials. Fanula, what have you got for us?
So this is the pedigree of a mare called The Blitz that I bought online on Bloodstock Auction as a maiden mare. And I think in September, was it 18? I think, from memory. And it was basically a few weeks prior. I was working at Aquas Farm at the time, and they had just acquired Jukebox to stand at stud, and I bought a breeding right on Jukebox and was specifically shopping for a mare to suit Jukebox. And this mare is a Blitz. She was a placed mare, but ended up paying $26,500 for her. So, and a lot of people, you know, you might wonder, why would I have paid so much for a placed daughter of Star Witness at that point in her career? But I think what stood out for me, I remember firstly, because as I say, I was looking for something specifically for Jukebox. You know, I had looked into, you know, what I thought would Nick well with A Son of Snitzel. I'd also looked at what would Nick well with, let's say, Not a Single Doubt, because Jukebox is bred on a very similar cross to Not a Single Doubt. Mm-hmm. And actually, Star Witness and Starcraft, those bloodlines, you know, were very good matches. So I had in mind that I wanted a daughter of Star Witness. So that's obviously one box ticked when I came across this mare. And then, while she's not a winner, again, when you look further, you know, a bit deeper into her race record, I think she had 9 starts and was placed in 4 or 5 of those and had 3 seconds. And, you know, a couple of those seconds were, she was just beaten at provincial level. So that was enough for me to, you know, think she had, like, from my point of view, she has enough ability. She wasn't a slow horse, per se. Perhaps just a bit unlucky not to have a couple of wins on the board. What I really like, she's out of a daughter of Zabil. You know, he's terrific when he appears in any part of a pedigree, really, particularly because he's such a good broodmare sire. It's nice to have him there on the distaff side of the page. You've got this Dana Hill back there, a few generations in Star Witness. So I didn't want to... a mare with Dane Hill too close up, because she'd be going to Jukebox. So again, that worked. But a big thing for me is her second dam is the Golden Slipper winner, Polar Success.
Yeah.
And it's just a lovely, lovely family, and it's quite a deep family. And one thing I probably should have mentioned earlier, one thing when I am particularly shopping for a brood mare, one thing I like to do is I'll, you know, look up the stud book and see who her maybe fourth dam is, and I'll actually pull a report from Arian on basically what that female line has done descending from the fourth dam. So it just gives me an idea, because, you know, if you go back 4 or 5 generations like that, you know, you could have anything from 50 runners to maybe 400 runners, you know, have directly descended from that female. So if they've got a lot of runners, but the stats are still very good, and there's still some Group 1 winners there on the page, and if the stakes winners to runners stats are very good, it's the kind of mare I want to buy, because she has a very high chance of, you know, continuing that trend in the family.
That's a really interesting point, Fionnuala. So you've gone back to Polar Maid, and you've run all of her descendants and all the branches off, so not just through Patu, but through all of her offspring. And presumably the more offspring that descend from that mare is a good insight into how successful the family's been, because people want to keep acquiring and breeding with this family, right?
Yeah, and also, like, if there's a lot of offspring descending from that one, you know, it, and if the stats are still reading high, well, then you know it is a particularly very well-performing family. You know, oftentimes, you know, you could have, let's say, I can't remember now off the top of my head how many descend from Polar Maid, but let's say if there was 300 and her the stats are reading that all those descendants have a 70% winning strike rate and maybe 10% stakes winners to runners strike rate, you know, that's definitely a very good producing family that you want to be a part of. And another thing with running a report like that is at a glance, you know, it'll list, you know, any stakes, you start with the stakes horses descending from that mare in question, but you can see at a glance the sires those horses are by and the bloodlines. So like if I suddenly start seeing that, oh, this family has already worked well with particular bloodlines of a sire that I had in mind for her, you know, again, it's another goal you're kicking. Also, you can see at a glance, you know, are all those good stakes horses in a particular family? I mean, are they by, you know, champion sires like Redoutes and Fastnet or I Am Invincible, or are they by maybe, you know, somewhat modest stallions? Because again, like, that's a positive, because it shows me, well, you know, that the family mightn't have been all that well bred up, but they're still getting great results. So, you know, if you were to put your mare then to a better stallion, you know, you'd like to think she'd have even a higher chance of producing a good horse for you.
Yeah, so the pedigree we're looking at is the one that you saw when you purchased Zablitz.
Yeah.
If someone looked at Zablitz's pedigree now, what would be the key differences that stood out? Because that's the thing about a pedigree, it's always evolving, right?
Yeah, sure. And like one thing, you know, like when I'm looking at this pedigree, at how it read when I bought her, like on, so she's herself is placed and she's out of an unraced mare, which isn't ideal. And that unraced mare at this point in time hadn't produced a stakes horse. But one thing I was banking on was I thought to myself, if Ziblitz's Dam Snowblitz was to produce a stakes horse, you know, it'll be a half sibling to my mare, and all of a sudden it changes the pedigree and makes it look a lot better, because, you know, all of a sudden you've a very well-bred mare that's, let's say, a half to a stakes horse, and they're out of a Golden Slipper winner. So one thing I was aware of on the page that you can see here, but at the time when, you know, when I would have done the research document, I could see that the yearling, I think it was rising two-year-old that, or maybe just turned two, that was out of Ziblitz's Dam, was a Zoo Star filly that had made 650,000 at Cracker that year. So, and that was before, you know, we were seeing the huge sale results, you know, that we're used to now at Zoo Star. But for me, that's a big positive, because, you know, one, when a horse makes that much, you know, they're going to a good trainer often. They're a very nice type to begin with. You know, from my point of view, you're more likely to get a good pedigree update. And then from a long-term point of view, you know, it's a filly as well. So then hopefully when she goes to the shed, she'll be well mated. And again, it'll continue that cycle of hopefully bringing more pedigree upgrades to you. So when you look at the pedigree now, that Zoo Star filly subsequently was called Tears of Jupiter and was stakes placed in New Zealand as a three-year-old. And she was actually quite unlucky, because it was the year that COVID pretty much stopped racing for quite a while in New Zealand. And it wasn't long after she'd won her stakes race placed in a stakes race, that the racing was shut down. So it sort of scuppered her three-year-old season when she was in good form. But that has brought a good pedigree update for the mares of Blitz. And then, you know, subsequent to that, under the second dam, you now have Lille Moore was a new stakes winner that's now appeared on the page. Lille Moore is by Hallowed Crown. You know, she was unraced at the time, but there was actually a few other progeny on the page by Hallowed Crown that had won in the city before Lille Moore came along. So, you know, when you'd have seen another unraced Hallowed Crown on the page at the time, you might have thought, well, hopefully that might do something, because his family has already worked with Hallowed Crown. And that turned out to be the case. And there's another stakes horse under the second dam, Pipali, that's relatively new. Roots, that good filly of Press Statements, is now on the page. So there's probably been three or four black type updates in the few years since this mare was purchased. And it has changed the look of the pedigree quite a bit and improved it.
That's an interesting, and presumably too, those updates help to, you purchase this mare with Jukebox in mind, but those updates help you to plan future matings and the like, right?
Yeah, of course. And then, you know, when the page starts improving, you know, it allows you maybe, you know, upgrade the stallions that I was using on her, you know, and you start spending a bit more money. Like I sent her to So You Think the second year. I think he was standing for 35,000 that year, and I remember thinking, well, I'm going to use him now because I won't be able to afford him probably the following year. And then sent him to American Pharaoh. So again, you take the opportunity as a family improves, you might start adjusting the money you spend on the stallions and the caliber of stallions you use.
That's really interesting. What a fun activity. All right, I've set a challenge for you. We just looked at something of a known quantity. Now let's look at this one, also available on our socials at A Horse Walks Pod. It is a yearling from Sale Past. We'll let people pause if they want to follow along at home. For those that are happy to just soak it in, we have a chestnut filly by Rubik out of Chadana, a My Boy Charlie half-sister to Adrian Knox Stakes Victrix Candelara. Second dam Chadana is a daughter of Jade Hunter and the formerly very fast mare Star County.
So when you first sent it through to me, I consciously didn't look up a research document initially, because at first glance, actually, it wasn't ringing a bell to me of who this horse would be now, which is probably no harm. So I was sort of looking at the the pedigree as it was presented at the classic sale a few years ago, and was able to have a bit of an unbiased opinion on it, I suppose. So the first thing, you know, I think it's a good example actually of what we've, from what we've spoken about earlier, because at a glance, you know, some people might straight away strike up this filly off their list. You know, they might think, oh, there's five dams on the page, not a whole heap of black type, and move on quite quickly. But for me, you know, you're looking at that point in the in his career, Rubik was ticking boxes. You know, when you look at the top there of what his progeny had done up to this point, you can see yes, had won a Group Two as a two-year-old. He has two other stakes winners there, and one thing that stands out is Rubisaki, because you can she's out of a Dane Hill line mare. You can see this filly's out of a Dane Hill line mare, so already. While he hasn't had a whole heap of first crop runners yet, you know, you can see that this filly is bred on a similar cross to one of his stakes winners. So that's a nice little positive for someone evaluating the pedigree. But then I'd probably look at the mare being out of My Boy Charlie and think, oh, he's a grand stallion, but he was no world beater. It's not necessarily a positive for me. But you go with, you know, you're not going to disregard it just on that, and you'll look up My Boy Charlie's stats, and you know, at that point he mightn't have had a heap of progeny as the broodmare sire. So when you go look at his sire results at that point, I think he had five Group One winners, but one of them importantly was a Peggy Jean, who won the Sire's Produce as a two-year-old. And what's worth noting about Peggy Jean being by My Boy Charlie and winning that two-year-old Group One is she's actually out of Lago Delight, who is by Encosta de Lago. So bred on a similar reverse.
The Sire of Rubik.
Yeah. And you're kind of thinking, you know, My Boy Charlie was able to get that good two-year-old Group One winner out of a, you know, by a stallion that was, you know, fairly under the radar. So there, he's not a horse to dismiss. And going a bit further down the page, what I always like to see is if there isn't much black type, I at least want them to be perhaps black type by a lesser stallion. So in this stage point, you can see Candelara, stakes winner, Group One placed by Real Saga. Again, Real Saga wasn't, you know, a top-tier stallion, and I'd imagine if you looked into it closer, you'd probably find Candelara might be one of his best progeny.
Yeah.
So that for me is a positive, because it's often an indicator that this female family is actually outperforming the, you know, the chances they've been given and the sires they've gone to. And one other thing that is worth noting with this is while there's five dams on the page, what's interesting is when you actually look at the number of runners from each of those dams, there haven't been too many, which sort of it does explain why there mightn't be as much black type on the page and why five dams are showing. So I can forgive that. Like if each of these dams had, you know, 10 or 12 foals each and they've had their chances and the page still looks like that, you might be striking it off. But at a first glance, that page is actually... reads quite well for what it is, and I think it's a good example of something you could find, you know, value in a classic sale, let's say, that actually there's a lot of potential in that page is probably the way to put it.
Yeah, that's potential. That is a good way to put it. I think your point about the number of foals is interesting, and also the efficiency of converting those foals to winners. So Jordana's had the nine foals. She's the second dam. Eight of them raced, six of them won. So that's a fairly good strike rate. Third dam, Star County, only had five foals, three winners. You know, fourth dam, Sharp Star, had three foals, two winners. I mean, it's the foals that they do have tend to have at least a modicum of ability.
Yeah, like, and even I took a screenshot on my phone here. I'm just looking. I looked up the, let's say, maternal descendants report from her fourth dam, and it hasn't changed much from how it would have looked if you researched it at the time. And basically, I'll remove one runner, which is the subject horse. So we would have had 16 runners, for 14 winners. So that's a very good stat in itself. It's an unusually low number of runners for, you know, for four generations back, but it's a very good stat. And then you can actually see here that two of them were group winners, and there was a third stakes horse. So, you know, you've got two stakes winners, three stakes horses from those 16 runners. So that's a very good stat from that point of view. And, you know, something you wouldn't learn straight off looking at that page, but just with a bit more digging and research, it would actually pique your interest to see that this actually is quite a well-performed family.
Particularly when you're shopping, we know it's at the classic sale, so we're shopping at the classic sale, where traditionally people are shopping for racehorses.
Yeah.
Less than residually valuable animals.
And I mean, you know, Rubik was probably one of the best stallions that was used by this family, because the other group winners are by a horse called County, they're by Real Saga, that one is on the page, and by Rapier. So yeah, not all household names for people. Another thing that, you know, you can see when you look at that classic catalogue page is there is already a winner by Rubik on it, Turnstile. So that's always a nice positive, you know, because as such, you know, you can see that only if, you know, Rubik wouldn't have had a heap of runners at this stage, but he's a stallion that has already been proven with this particular family, so that's a positive.
Yeah, and a two-year-old winner at that.
Yeah. So that's like from the starting point. So like if I was a trainer shopping at the classic sale, I'd certainly have that filly on my list. And, you know, from there, I'd often, particularly with those lighter pages, it can be quite useful to actually run reports through the likes of Group 1 Goldmine or Pedigrees 360 and see how it actually... see how it rates as a, you know, the, let's say, potential racing potential of that particular mating. And that can be very helpful as well.
So it seems to me, just before we reveal the horse we're talking about, it seems to me that you're a big fan of that. Use as many tools as you've got at your disposal, but make sure that the information you're putting in is real. It's not just a matter of feeding an entire catalogue into the many tools that are now offered for assessing pedigrees. It's you do the hard work, and then you validate your thinking using these tools. Is that a fair read?
Yeah, I think so, pretty much. And then often, you know, those tools might help you, you know, shorten your list, or it'll give you another reason to like this horse more, you know, and give you another reason to want to buy it if you like what you see when you inspect the animal.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, this filly was offered by Carramar Park at the 2021 Classic Sale, and she realised $20,000, so not a lot of money. She now races as Opal Ridge for Luke Pepper, and last spring she earned a black type placing in the Heritage Stakes and finished her campaign with victory in the $500,000 Tap Craig. She's won $500,000, so not a bad return on a $20,000 outlay.
Yeah, it's very good, yeah. And it just goes to show, like, she, that pedigree is probably a typical diamond in the rough sort of page, you know. And I think it's a good one, because if you're someone that has too stringent rules, like, you know, I'll only buy something if it's got a Group 1 winner on the page, or I won't buy something if there's more than three dams or four dams showing on the page, you know, you would have struck this horse off your list before you ever had her on the list or ever had her on a list to inspect. So I think it's a good one to show why you have to be a bit more open-minded and don't take the information at face value often, you know. Like, as I say, even the, I think the few city winners that are under her first dam there, I think, you know, after when I looked them up in a research document, they were by Snippetson and that sort of level of stallion. So again, you know, it's more proof that, you know, that Real Saga filly, I think, wasn't just a fluke. You know, I think when you actually start researching that family, you see, geez, they keep getting quite good horses for by mediocre stallions. And now one's gone to a good stallion in Rubik, you know, it's a big plus if you're trying to find value.
Yeah. Oh, well, thanks, Fionnuala. That was a lot of fun. Hopefully our listeners take something away from it. I'm going to finish by asking you a final question. What's your personal favourite type of sale? What are the sales you look forward to each year in terms of yearling, broodmare, racing stock, ready to run. What's the one you lean to most personally?
I think the broodmare sales, definitely. I really like, I always enjoy too when the international mare sales are on. You know, I enjoy looking through those catalogues because I find it, I'm always learning something, you know, like I'll literally, there'll be mares by stallions I haven't heard of, you know, I'll stop and take the time to learn a bit about those particular stallions. And then, you know, you start, you know, asking questions about, you know, do you think they might work here? Why might they work here? Why mightn't they work here? So I always enjoy going through mare catalogues in particular. And then again, yeah, the same with the online ones. I love veering in on the race fillies and mares section, you know, and as I say, I love trying to be a bit sneaky and find one that might be flying under the radar a bit and see if I can buy it and flip it or, you know, pinhook it, and yeah, it's a bit of fun.
Thanks again, Fionnuala. I really enjoyed that, and that's it for this episode, and in fact that's it for a little while. We'll be taking our hiatus on A Horse Walks Into a Bar for a short period. During that time, we'll be tinkering with the format to give you more of what you love and come back strong. Keep an eye on social media at A Horse Walks Pod, but for now, this horse has walked.